This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode number 810, 810. Thank you so much for joining me today. Listeners from around the world, we appreciate you so much. And we've got a good show for you today. Now, today is what? It is a 10th episode show. That means we talk about something of general interest. But in the monologue, I want to talk to you about some very specific real estate stuff. In fact, another one of my predictions is coming true. Yes, imagine that. Another one of my many predictions that has come true. Another one is coming true. I couldn't believe it. I heard this one in the Wall Street Journal just the other day. And I will play a clip from that because it's pretty darn interesting. Pretty darn interesting. On the last show, we talked a little bit about real estate tools and keeping score and all of that good stuff. Make sure you visit realestatetools.com so that you can download iPhone and iPad apps and use the SaaS software, SaaS meaning software as a service product online. Take advantage of that just to make you a better investor so you understand how to keep score. Because many times, as we've talked about over the last 809 episodes, investors are winning the game, but they sometimes think they're losing the game just because they don't know how to keep score. And the opposite is also true. Many investors in these crazy cyclical markets think they are winning the game when they are really losing the game. How we as humans deceive ourselves. How we do not understand the profound impact of things unseen. Yes, the dogs that didn't bark. The dogs that don't bark. We can't hear those dogs that didn't bark, right? A very important concept as real estate investors. But before we get to our guest today, who is, by the way, the esteemed Cal Newport. Cal Newport, he has written a couple of great books. One that I just finished. Well, I actually just finished both of them. One is called Deep Work. Deep Work. And that's all about how we can really get some deep work done. Rules for focused success in a distracted world. And the other one is called So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. You know, he's a Georgetown University professor. He was an MIT professor, and he's just got a great background, and those books are excellent. I finished both of them just recently, and, you know, I tell you, the deep work, that is something I need. I have a feeling it's something we all need. I always feel this show could be so much better. I know, you're probably all thinking, Jason, it can't get any better. The show is so good. Yeah. Anyway, whatever. Okay, enough of this ego gratification here. A little bit of ego gratification, a little bit of patting oneself on the back here with another prediction of mine that is coming true. Now, I'm going to play for you a clip from the Wall Street Journal, and this is the audio version of the Wall Street Journal. Obviously, I think you've probably gathered that by now, as it talks about migration patterns and how my prediction that I have made many times starting a long time ago, which is the resurgence of the suburbs. Yes, baby. The good old burbs are coming back. The suburbs are going to be the new thing, the next big thing. And remember, that was Michael Lewis's old book, The New Thing, you know, talking about Silicon Valley and all that good stuff in the old days. Well, not that old, but, you know, like the first dot-com revolution in the 2000s era. The new thing is the suburbs. Why is it that way? Why have I made that prediction? Well, because the autonomous car is a game changer. Now, let's hope that we don't only see this from Tesla, because you know I'm on my second Tesla and I have a zillion complaints. This one has been a terrible experience, and I think Tesla has just dropped the ball. In fact, if Elon Musk ever gets us to Mars, right? Guess what's going to happen? The doors to the spaceship aren't going to open and close properly. And yes, our Martian astronauts will probably be stuck inside, not able to go out and explore Mars, because that's pretty much the experience I've had with my stupid Tesla Model X. Yes, I'm quite upset about this. You know, I think I need like a lemon law attorney or something, because I got to do something about this car. I'm just really quite upset with them. But they are the leader now in the self-driving car world, in the autonomous vehicle world, and there are a whole bunch of other initiatives out there, and I think this is going to be one of the big pieces of fuel for the resurgence of the suburbs. Suburbia is coming back, baby. Now, you know, suburbia is pretty much an American concept. This concept of, you've got, you know, when you're looking at land development, you've got urban areas, right? The cities, you've got suburban areas and the burbs, right? And America is all about the burbs. And then you've got the exurbs as well, right? But the suburbs, in fact, there is a song by a great band about it. That band is called Rush, the most talented band ever in human history, just so you know. The one that exposed me to the late, great Ayn Rand and all of her brilliant work and all of her brilliant writings, whether they be Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead or whatever, make sure you check out Ayn Rand's writings. Yes, Rush, through their lyrics and their songs, exposed me to Ayn Rand. Yeah, I know, it's an odd way to learn about Ayn Rand. It wasn't in literature class, I'll tell you that much. They've got a song called Subdivisions, and it's about the suburbs, right? And how they're just this sort of bland, boring place, blah, blah, blah. But the suburbs have some big advantages, right? Less expensive real estate, you get space, you get a yard, you get all this kind of stuff. The disadvantage is you've got to commute. And the old saying in real estate is that people drive until they qualify. They drive until they qualify for that home loan, in other words, right? And tenants will drive until they can afford the rent. The rent is too damn high. Yeah, we heard that before. Remember that guy? Was he like running for president or something years ago? The rent is too damn high campaign. Hilarious. So we see this, and then we add to that the self-driving car and the advantages of the suburbs. Now, the suburbs, you know, of course, they became really popular in the post-World War II era. And we saw Levittown being the first, I think that was at least the first big giant suburban development, right? And then we saw it happen all over the country. And this is a very United States type concept, the suburbs. And the suburbs grew and grew for a long time during the 50s and still the post-World War II era, obviously. We had the romance of the automobile and all those great 50s cars. And, you know, the Venture Alliance, by the way, is thinking of doing a trip to Cuba for the Venture Alliance Mastermind Group. And what you'll notice, and I've been to Cuba before, I was there maybe 12-ish years ago. What you'll notice about Cuba is that it's literally a place where time stopped in 1959 when Castro took over. That's what communism does, and to a lesser degree, that's what socialism does. It basically freezes everything in time, and time stops. And it's very unhealthy, and it's terrible, and we all know that, right? So thank God Bernie Sanders didn't win, right? And, you know, thank God the criminal known as Hillary Clinton didn't win either. Trump, I don't know, the jury's out on that guy. He's got some problems too, but anyway, whatever, I'll take my gamble on him. And I'm going to share with you, by the way, on a future episode, something really interesting about some of Trump's failures already in his presidency and how applying the business ethic doesn't really work that well in politics. I think I've been mistaken about this. I'm really happy generally to see a business person in the White House, and I'm really happy to see a real estate person in the White House, our first real estate president, good old Donald Trump. But, you know, he's got some concerns, to say the least, right? And I'm going to share with you in a future episode something really quite fascinating about some of his failures so far as president and why he's failed and how it differs from business, how politics is so different from it. So kind of interesting stuff. But hey, look, it for better or worse, I think it's at least better than another damn career politician. So we will see how it all works out. Too early to tell, T-E-T-T, too early to tell. The jury is still out on the Trump presidency, of course. But in terms of talking about the rise of the suburbs, now this article from the Wall Street Journal, March 24th, is not exactly nailing this right on the head, but it's a pretty strong piece of evidence. So listen to this. It's just a couple minutes long.
Section of the Wall Street Journal. The outer suburbs are once again outgrowing cities, by Paul Overberg. Last year saw the strongest evidence yet that Americans are returning to traditional patterns in where they move, from cities to suburbs and from north to south, after a recession-driven pause of nearly a decade. Central counties of metropolitan areas grew 0.7% last year, while outlying counties grew 1%, according to new Census Bureau population estimates for the year that ended July 1st. After 2 years of roughly comparable growth, this marked the first time since the recession that outer suburbs clearly outgrew central cities and inner suburbs. As recently as 2012, central counties grew 0.9% and outlying counties just 0.5%. A combination of economic and demographic trends contributed to the shift, said William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution. He said much of it can be traced to growing migration losses by central counties as job gains spread to more areas and industries. That has triggered recession-delayed movement by millennials establishing themselves and their families, he said. The shift spells good news for Sunbelt metros that had seen strong migration from the north cut sharply since the housing market collapse and recession of 2007 to 2009. Las Vegas lost 5,000 movers more than it gained in 2011, but last year gained a net 28,000.
Wow.
Phoenix saw a gain of 4,000 in 2011, ballooned to 51,000 last year.
51,000.
Many metros saw migration gains dip from 2015, but remain at more than twice the levels of 2011
Listen to this.
2013, including Tampa, Jacksonville, Deltona, Daytona Beach, Lakeland, Palm Bay, and Port St. Lucie.
And the vast majority of those, by the way, are markets we either are currently recommending or have recommended. Just want to point that out as well.
Within Sunbelt metros, gains are shifting to the edges. Davidson County, Tennessee, the center of the 14-county Nashville metro, grew almost 1% last year, but a net 2,000 people moved to the rest of the country, its first net loss in domestic migration since the recession. However, suburban counties like Williamson, Rutherford, Wilson, and Sumner continued to draw more movers than they lost and grew an average of more than 3% last year. Sunbelt gains are sapping some of the nation's largest metros, which also face low birth rates, aging populations, and scant immigration. Fry said that 16 of the 100 largest metros actually lost population last year, including Chicago, Cleveland, New Haven, Connecticut, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, New York, Milwaukee, Rochester, New York, and Akron, Ohio. Other large metros continued to grow slowly, but saw migration gains as recent as 2011 turn into losses. Among them, Washington, Miami, Boston, San Diego, Louisville, Kentucky, and New Orleans. The trend of migration losses even reached into Silicon Valley, where a red-hot tech economy has sent housing prices soaring. Last year, the San Francisco metro area lost more residents to the rest of the country than it gained for the first time since the recession. Small annual losses in the San Jose metro area grew sharply. Together, they lost a net 33,000 movers to the rest of the country, up from an average of 17,000 in recent years. The overall population still grew slightly, boosted by immigration and a relatively high birth rate. Rural counties next to metro areas also resumed growing, said Kenneth Johnson, a demographer at the University of New Hampshire. He said this reflects the return of edge-focused growth that prevailed before the recession.
All right. So thank you to the Wall Street Journal for that and for showing me how accurate another one of my predictions has been. The rise of the suburbs, they didn't even mention the self-driving car, which takes the whole issue of the commute and lessens its impact and actually possibly makes it an advantage, possibly makes it pleasurable. You know, I really do miss driving to some extent because it's hard for me to keep up on all my podcasts that I want to listen to, right? So, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way because you got to make sure you get every episode of the Creating Wealth Show in there and all my other podcasts. In either case, I just wanted to share that with you. We'll keep an eye on these trends. They're obviously very complex, as you can hear from that Wall Street Journal article. There is definitely quite a bit of complexity, but the overriding prediction is the resurgence or the rise of the suburbs. They're coming back because of the self-driving car. That is going to have a huge impact. It is a game changer. Remember, the three primary rules of real estate since the beginning of time: location, location, location. That is changing. That paradigm is going to shift. Not completely, but to a large extent, larger than it ever has in human history. You know what I always say? And this is tweetable. This is a good Jason Hartman quote. You ready? Geography is less meaningful than it's ever been in human history. Geography is less meaningful than it's ever been in human history. Be sure to check out Suburban Properties at jasonhartman.com and all the other properties we have as well. And check that out. And also keep up on all of our upcoming events. We are going to announce some new events soon. Maybe a JHU, Jason Hartman University live seminar coming up. So stay tuned for that. We will be announcing them. We've got our Memphis property tour this week, or this weekend, I should say. Let's get to our 10th show content and talk to Cal Newport about deep work and about being so good they can't ignore you. It's my pleasure to welcome Cal Newport to the show. He is a professor of computer science at Georgetown University, author of the best-selling books Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World, and So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. Cal, welcome. How are you?
Hi, Jason. I'm doing fine.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So I finished Deep Work a few weeks ago and really enjoyed it. An excellent, excellent book. Then I'm just digging into So Good They Can't Ignore You, maybe a third of the way through that one, and enjoying that one as well. And you've really taken some of the things that we do in the modern world, and you've been critical of them and turned them on their head. And I think you're on to something. Certainly, the reviews on Amazon are would say you're onto something. Tell us more, and you know, start with either book, feel free to jump between the two.
Yeah, I am a bit of a professional curmudgeon, it seems like, these days, but it's fun to do. So, I mean, let me just give the log line for both books, essentially. So I wrote this book back in 2012, So Good They Can't Ignore You, which made the claim that this advice that everyone gives, follow your passion, is bad advice, and that it will actually hurt your chances of ending up loving your work. And then in 2016, I published Deep Work, which making this claim that, you know, the ability to focus really intensely is actually really, really valuable. And it's becoming more valuable just at the same time that people are becoming worse at it as they focus instead on connectivity and visibility and busyness. And therefore, if you're one of the few people to cultivate that, you're going to have a huge advantage. So it's in both cases, I'm end up pushing back against something that a lot of people sort of just assumed was good.
Now, you know, I want to ask you the deep work problem, if you will, or the lack of deep work that just pervades our distracted world. You know, I remember before Al Gore invented the internet, just kidding, you know, in the old days, before we had social media, before we had email, before we, you know, back then you were distracted by fax machines, right? And phone calls. You know, I mean, we always had distractions, right? I remember Dennis Waitley years ago quoting an article from the 1800s in the Boston Globe about how people were overwhelmed with all this information coming at them. And you know, this is not a new phenomenon. Certainly, there's more distraction now, but maybe we are evolving and getting better at dealing with it. I don't know. Just wanted to throw that idea out there.
There's always been, I mean, any of these issues, there's always some sort of historical precedent. And in some cases, actually, the historical precedent for worries were true. If you look back, for example, around the rise of television, especially as we went through the 60s to the 70s, people said, well, wait a second, this thing, we're going to be watching these things all the time. Well, it turns out they were right. People watch an incredible amount of television. Actually, those concerns were right. It drastically changed how people spent their time and introduced a whole new culture where for many people, you come home from work and you put on the TV till bedtime. And that hasn't changed. So sometimes these historical concerns are true. But there's two things that I think make what's going on now exceptional. One has to do with the actual quality of the distractions themselves. We've never seen anything that even approaches the grip on our time and attention that you see with modern digital mobile devices. I mean, sure, you go back to Thoreau and he says, isn't it distracting that you could get a telegraph, you know, coming in while you're trying to work on something?
yeah, exactly.
But Thoreau was not dealing with someone having a telegraph on them and checking it 300 to 400 times a day, 300 to 400 telegraphs a day, and rarely going more than 6 minutes without actually writing a telegraph. And even with concerns like television, like we watch too much television, but we didn't have people bringing their televisions into their office and putting them on their desk and checking it every 2 to 3 minutes to see what was on TV, right? Which is what's happening with these distractions. So I think the quantity and the quality of the addictiveness of this is something that we haven't even come close to seeing before with any of these other former technological concerns. And the other issue is our economy has evolved so that more and more people are in professional positions where these type of distractions directly and negatively impact what they do for a living. So there's a difference here. You might look back to the office cultures of the 60s and say, well, we used to chat around the water cooler and maybe, you know, I would get some calls. But we had much fewer people in the 1960s who were trying to do high-level creative knowledge work, who were really using their brain at a very high level to create value. So I think we have two trends coming together. It's more an order of magnitude more distracting or addictive than we've ever seen at a time where more and more people are vulnerable for that to make a difference.
Well, that's an interesting point. So as we've had the, I'll call it the crisis of distraction, we also have the greater need for creative thinking. And, you know, I hate to use the cliched new age term mindfulness, but for lack of a better, you know, well, I'll use deep work. That's a better term. But yeah, I would agree with you because in the old days, you know, people did more assembly line style work, right? And now the modern world really demands a more creative mind and certainly rewards a more creative mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely what's true. So if you go back to, you know, the 1970s and say you look at someone from the, you know, the typing pool who's maybe gossiping around the water cooler a few times during the day, has a negligible impact on the output that this person does, which is more or less he or she's typing about this much stuff. And if and maybe there's a 10% loss there. That's very different than if you're trying to do business strategy or trying to program a computer or trying to write something difficult. And you're doing just checks on inboxes and social media accounts every 5 to 6 minutes, which puts you in a state of reduced cognitive capacity. You produce worse stuff and you produce stuff at a slower rate. And that's your primary obligation. So the right analogy going back to the typing pool in the 60s is not someone leaving the gossip around the water cooler a few times during the day. It would be like if they were gossiping with someone the whole time while they were typing and they were making lots of mistakes and going much slower. And that circumstance, we said, well, this is crazy. You can't sit here and talk to your friend while you're trying to type up the memos because you're making lots of mistakes and you've dropped your rate by 50%. But it's essentially what we're doing in the newly emerged sort of high-level knowledge work economy. We just don't realize it yet. We just don't have that metric that says your words per minute is half of what it used to be. And so this is what I think is unsustainable.
So, Cal, I don't think there's anyone listening that doubts we are distracted. And one of the things I really like that you said in the book was something to the effect of if one spends their time on, for example, social media, they can leave a lot of little trails and pieces of their knowledge and creativity around in little post on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. But if they spend their time writing a book, then they will leave something big that lasts forever, right? And it's you know, more timeless. And maybe you want to just correct me on that quote or idea there. But, you know, I think that's a good point, isn't it?
Yeah, that idea first came from an essay that the science fiction novelist Neal Stephenson wrote called Why I'm a Bad Correspondent. And it hit me, as it makes a lot of sense when you heard it. He says, I don't really answer people's emails, and I'm not going to come to your conference, and I'm not going to send you back assigned whatever. And he says, I know for each individual this seems selfish because it would have only taken me 1 minute to do that response or 2 minutes to do that response. But he said, if I do that for everyone who starts writing me, then what am I left with in the end is that there's a large group of people who got a very little thing from me. And if I instead consolidate that all to write a book, there can be a lot of people that read that for decades to come. So I'm going to prioritize that. And it was an important point when I heard it, that when you're measuring the impact of various communication and digital behaviors, don't just take the one isolated instance. How long does it really take me to read this tweet or reply to this email? You have to think about the cumulative impact that it has on your time and attention and think, well, what else could I be dedicating that to? And how do I compare the value?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So what is the solution to the problem? I think we all know the problem. We live in this distracted world. I mean, even our posture and our shoulders are being affected by smartphones because we're just looking at them constantly. If you're single, my God, it's impossible to meet or talk to anybody anymore. They're all looking at their stupid phone. In fact, there's a video about it on YouTube. It's called Look Up, and it's very telling. You know, the two people, the male and the female, they go through their, it shows them going through their whole day looking at their phone, and they keep passing each other. And they would have been attracted to each other. it's a great video. But what can we do about this?
Yeah, well, there's several things you can do. The first thing is that to break the addiction to the phone, I think, is crucial. And keep in mind, if this helps put it into context, that the way that Silicon Valley and especially social media and website media companies think about your phone and you is it's a mobile billboard device. And their question is, okay, how can we get people to take out this thing and look at our ads in places that we can't otherwise put billboards? I mean, how can we expand where we can actually do advertisements? So the whole key to their industry is how can we convince people to, wherever they are, take out this phone and look at our ads? And they realize the way to do it is to make the products addictive. If you can foster a behavioral addiction, now you have someone who in the bathroom, waiting in line, in a moments of downtime at a movie, are going to continually pull out your thing and load up your app and look at your ads. You've just solved the massive problem in advertising. You can now put billboards everywhere that person is. So it's a great business model from the perspective of these companies, but it's a terrible bargain for you. And so I like the think about it that way, because I think it changes the feel you have towards your usage of these devices, away from I'm high tech, I'm a first adopter, I'm a digital native, I'm on the cutting edge, and instead see it more, I'm being exploited. I'm having my attention just mined out of my head by these companies so that they can increase that profit margin. So my advice for the first step, which is breaking free of the addiction of the phone, is take all those social media networks that you're convinced are crucial to your business, your life, and your place in the world. You don't have to quit them. Take the apps off your phone. If they're really that important to your life and to your business and your place in the world, then you can very easily log on to your computer when you happen to be at your computer at home and do all the very important things you do on them. But it takes away the addiction machine off your phone. It takes away the apps that they have people engineering to be as addictive as possible. So that'd be my first recommendation, is take every one of those apps off the phone, just access them through a web browser.
Okay, so before you go on, Cal, let's just play devil's advocate with that one for a moment. I see what you're saying, and you know, I kind of brought that issue up, so you know, I agree. However, there's a good side to that too, right? Because in the old days, there was a lot of downtime while you're waiting in line, while you're waiting for something. You know, now there's virtually no downtime, which one could certainly argue means that we're not having any freewheeling thinking time anymore. But also, it's certainly more efficient that we can look at our email, manage our social media, you know, during this kind of downtime, you know, rather than, I mean, if we take it all off our smartphone, won't we just be sitting in front of our computer more and doing it at home rather than paying attention to something else?
No, I don't think that's true. Well, first of all, what I found is when people bring their social media off of their phone is they use it drastically less. Because you tell yourself the story that this is a crucial part of XYZ in my life. That's why I'm using it so much. But the reality was I like the quick hit of entertainment when on board. This thing is engineered to give me quick hits of dopamine. It feels good. It helps alleviate boredom. So when you actually put up a little bit of barrier to use it, you say, well, I'm not going to go log onto my computer to go to Facebook. I don't care that much. I mean, that's too much of a border. So I don't think that's going to add more time. But more importantly, I think that downtime is crucial, not just because it supports your brain to rest or recharge or do freewheeling thinking, but what happens or what I've seen happen is that when people fill every moment of boredom with a quick hit of entertainment coming off of their phone, it builds a Pavlovian connection in their mind that at the slightest hint of boredom, I get relief. Once you've built that Pavlovian connection, when it comes time to actually do something hard, something meaningful that's going to create value for your life or your career, your brain won't tolerate it, which is why the very first thing I have to do when I'm training people to get better at concentrating and producing cognitive output of real value is I say, you have to embrace boredom. You have to have lots and lots of time in your life where you're bored and do nothing about it, because until you break that connection that your brain has between I feel bored, I get a treat, I feel bored, I get a treat. If you don't break that connection, when it comes time to do the serious stuff, you're not going to be able to do it. And I think we have a whole generation who has that connection so strong that they are unable to. Even you locked them in a Faraday cage with no electronics and said, here's your notebook and just no option to produce work, they can't do it. The brain won't tolerate it. So I like boredom. To me, the discomfort of boredom is like the slight discomfort you feel when you're exercising. You're like, well, yeah, it feels uncomfortable to be lifting this weight, but it's making me stronger. And so I'm happier, motivated to be doing it.
Right. It's just hard to quantify that gain, if you will. You know, when you go to the gym, the endorphins are pumping afterwards. You feel the muscle soreness, which sort of feels good if you didn't overdo it too much. I mean, you know, it feels like you've accomplished something. But if you take your stuff off your phone, I mean, it's not just entertainment. It's email. It's text. It's functional stuff, too, that isn't always business, but sometimes it is. You can't really notice the gain. Is there any way to quantify this?
Well, I think what you'll notice once you build a deep work habit. So once people have started to hone their ability to concentrate, so partially by embracing boredom and partially by doing exercises for it, and once they've started to systematically block off time to do this type of deep thinking, there is a sort of positive, almost addictive type feeling you get once you realize, oh, this is what it feels like to produce for 3 hours at a high level of uninterrupted cognitive state. When you see what you produce, when you feel the satisfaction of keeping your concentration on one product and actually making progress with it, that actually becomes addictive. So just like the athlete who feels motivated to avoid the junk food, because they really feel good when they know they're gonna have a good workout the next day or good performance on the field. You can get that same connection with deep work. You start to see the stuff that's engineered to be distracted or the really addictive behaviors as cognitive junk food. It becomes easier and easier to be proud about the fact that you avoid it or that you don't make it a major part of your life. And I think this is such an interesting topic because a lot of what people think they're filling this downtime for, a lot of the stuff that people think is making them more productive, I think is largely invented. I mean, almost no one I know is paid on the basis of how many emails they send. No one I know is making a lot of money from if you check this many social medias versus this many social media accounts. But I know a lot of people that make a lot of money for things that require very long, uninterrupted concentration. And whether or not they're easy to reach via text or email between that is not as important maybe as we think.
So, Cal, any other tips on the deep work habit on developing this muscle?
Yeah, two quick things I would recommend. One is an exercise I call productive meditation. And this is where you go for a walk. And while you're walking, you try to make progress on a professional problem just in your mind. So you just think about it. And just like in mindfulness meditation, when you notice your attention is wandering from the problem to something else, you just notice that and bring it back to the professional problem. What I found is if you do this productive meditation, it's like doing pull-ups for your physical body. It's very, very hard at first, and then you get better and better at it, and it gives very large returns in terms of your ability to sustain concentration. The other small tip I'd recommend is start putting on your calendar a couple weeks in advance blocks of time for deep work that you treat and protect like you would any other meeting or appointment. So if someone comes up later and says, hey, can we have a call at noon on Tuesday? And that's in the middle of one of these blocks. You say, no, I have a thing, but I'll be free again at 2. You treat it like a doctor's appointment or a meeting with clients. This just gets you into the habit of, on a regular basis, applying deep thinking to things that matter. And it really requires that type of protection in advance to make sure it happens. Those two things alone, in just a few weeks, you'll notice a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
So another thing I like to recommend to people is, when it comes to entertainment or information that can be addictive for you, we talked about taking apps off the phone. The other thing I recommend for people is to reverse the digital Shabbat idea, this idea that, oh, I take a little bit of time each week when I'm not connected to all those things, and you reverse it. And you say, okay, I'm going to put aside some time when I'm going to go online and be connected to these sort of entertaining but distracting sources of entertainment. So you say, you know, hey, tonight from 7 to 8, I'm going to go and do all my social media, no holds barred, right? I'm going to browse, I'm going to find fun stuff, I'm going to read, you know, funny things on Twitter, it doesn't matter, but I'm going to wait till that time to do it. Same thing with text messaging. It's very easy to fall into a series of expectations with people in your life that you're always accessible by text messages. The easy way to change it is to put aside times throughout your day to when you're going to look at what's in your text message inboxes and try to respond to people, and then just not check it in between those times. And at first, people will be a little bit confused. Hey, Jason, I was trying to reach you. Where were you? But you'll still get back to them within 4 or 5 hours. And people very quickly adjust to this idea that, okay, Jason is not always accessible on text messages. Sometimes he has his phone, sometimes he doesn't, and people adjust. So a couple small things like that can change this background hum of constant stimulation and communication and make it into much more concentrated blocks without you losing almost any access to the good things that these networks bring you. It's just controlling how you use it more so than it is aggressively culling what you actually use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. You know, Cal, in the old days when it was just the telephone, I used to, well, on and off. I didn't do it very consistently, but there were some days when I'd check my voicemail and do my phone calls a couple of times a day, you know, in the morning and then in the afternoon. And what I found, amazingly, is that a lot of problems just solve themselves. You know, and sometimes by the time I would engage in that issue, it was resolved, and I wasn't even really needed in the first place. And I think it's kind of what Stephen Covey used to talk about this urgency addiction. And I mean, all of this technology and social media really just add to this urgency addiction. It makes us all feel like we're necessary, we're needed, we got to be there, we got to be involved. We really don't, a lot of times, right?
Yeah, it is highly invented. I like to talk about the distinction between productivity and true productivity. Productivity, the way that people like to talk about it, is defined very locally. I'm making progress on tasks that I need to do. Things are happening. I'm making progress on things in my life. And so I got this email out quicker. I have Slack, so I can respond to this real quick. It's just busyness generates productivity. True productivity is, how much value are you actually creating? I mean, how much did you create that's going to move the bottom line on your company or the company you work for, that's going to bring in more value to the company than what was there before? And the reality is, those are two very different things. And in some points, they can be completely unconnected. In fact, to maximize true productivity often can make you pretty bad at the other type of productivity. Maybe you're less accessible, you're hard to get in touch with, there's even some things get dropped, opportunities are missed. But on the other hand, the thing you produce that you're best at, the thing that brings the most value, you're able to actually do at a high level. And so I think we're going to see, or I hope we'll see, more of a separation in people's thinking going forward between true productivity, what do I produce that's worth dollars and cents, and this low-level, non-valued productivity, which is a much more mixed bag.
Yeah, I think those are some very good points. We've sort of railed on technology a bit during our talk today, but there are certainly a plethora of apps out there that try and help with this stuff. You know, some people use the sort of Pomodoro timer technique. Other people use use various apps that literally lock their social media on their computer and only make it accessible certain times of day. Do you have any recommendations for technology that might help solve the problem rather than create the problem?
Well, one thing I've seen people be successful with is applications like Freedom, and there's a lot of other variations, but it allows you to not only block particular apps or websites, but do so across all your devices, so, which I think is pretty effective for people who do maintain or need to maintain presences on services that are engineered to be addictive, and yet they need to be on them for particular professional or personal reasons. This is an incredibly valuable training tool because you can say, I'm now locked for 3 hours when I'm going to work on this thing, and it takes the option off the table. And you'd be surprised by how much mental energy that frees up for you to actually apply to the task at hand when you don't have to service one part of your brain that's consistently saying, well, maybe I should check. Maybe we should check. Maybe I should check. If it's blocked, that part goes away. It knows for a fact it can't check for another 3 hours. So I've seen people use that as a successful detox tool.
So the app is called Freedom.
Freedom, yep.
That's the name of the app. Okay, interesting. I haven't heard of that one. I've heard of some others. Very good. Cal, one of the things we talked about a little bit just before we started, as we were talking for a moment, is this frustration that I was complaining about. And, you know, whenever I hire a professional nowadays, it seems like it's getting harder and harder to find a person that you call in your other book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, a craftsman. And what I mean by that, I know, is a little different than what you talk about in the So Good They Can't Ignore You book, but everybody's like a marketer nowadays, and they're just out there wanting to take over the world. And, you know, they're doing social media, they're doing ads, and they're doing internet marketing and all this stuff. And it's like, could I please just have a lawyer or an accountant who sits at their desk and churns out great work? It seems like this distraction problem is just massive. I mean, the quality of work, the depth of thought is It's kind of pathetic how bad it's getting. And I'm not saying I'm not affected by it. I think I am. I got to manage this problem within myself, but also amongst my contractors, too.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right about this. I wrote an op-ed about this back in November for The New York Times that created actually a lot of heated controversy. But essentially what I said in this op-ed was, if you really study the intersection of social media and people's careers, we've been largely sold a bill of goods that we are wildly overestimating how much value you get in your career for slavishly maintaining these very active presences on all these social media platforms that we're told you have to do or you won't be noticed. We're wildly overestimating that value, while at the same time, we're wildly underestimating the impact it has on us actually doing what we do well. And that the real story is, in many, many different fields, social media is very new. These fields have been around for a long time. For decades and decades and decades, they've had in place very robust mechanisms for recognizing and rewarding talent. There's very few fields I can find that 6 years ago, when social media use became ubiquitous, said, let's get rid of all of the channels we've had and have evolved over the decades that help train people and identify talented people and reward talented people. Let's just look at Twitter. Or let's just look at Facebook. That's how we're going to decide who's a good lawyer or who's a good real estate agent. Didn't happen. These fields have been around forever, and they've known how to identify and reward talent. And consistently what you find is the people who do things at a high level have more work and more opportunities than they know what to do with. And so the strategy hasn't really changed. You know, if you want to excel in your career, find a thing that's most valuable in your field and really work hard to do it really, really well. I named the book I wrote 2 books ago, So Good They Can't Ignore You. That's a quote from Steve Martin, who said when he's asked by people, how do I succeed in entertainment? How do I get the right agent? How do I get noticed? He said, the answer I give is never what they want to hear, but it's that you should be so good they can't ignore you. And if you do that, he said, all the other good things come. they all follow from that. That's where your energy should go. And he said they don't like that answer because they want to know, well, how do I do this? How do I get visible? Maybe if I have the right agent, how do I maneuver myself? He said, none of that matters. It all follows. All you have to do is be so good they can't ignore you. That's the message, I think, of the social media age, is we've been sold this bill of goods that that's what matters. And I've been studying this. I've been writing about this. I've been traveling the country speaking about this and listening to people's stories about this. In almost every field, the market is pretty rational. If you're doing something valuable well, people want you. And if you don't, they don't, regardless of how active your Facebook page is.
It almost can be this sort of a counterintuitive measure of one's quality or lack of quality because, you know, I'll give you an example. There's a lawyer CPA that I worked with for a few years and, you know, he's just all over the place on the speaking circuit, on, you know, on all the social media, doing all the internet marketing stuff. And I just noticed after a while that the quality of work just wasn't very good. But, you know, to see kind of the public image that you would see out there, you'd think, oh, this guy's got to be great, right? You know, but interestingly, it's complete opposite, at least in my humble opinion. So that can almost be a measure. But do we need to make a distinction, Cal, that in some businesses, the person who's kind of out there a lot, that is their business. I'll give you an example. A financial advisor friend of mine, you know, she said to me one day that her job basically is networking. That's her job. And, you know, she's not the one that's going to give you great investment advice. Her whole role was to just bring money in and let the management people in her company, you know, do their thing. But someone has got to be the wonky craftsman person, right? And then there are other people who go out there and they're the rainmakers and they bring in the business. And I think it's very important that we don't confuse the two. The rainmaker is rarely the expert. They're just the rainmaker. They're the expert at making rain. They're the expert at networking. They're the expert at social media and, you know, branding and stuff like that, right? But they're not the expert at the actual trade of practicing law or accounting, for example. Any comments on that thought?
Well, I think it's an important distinction, and in part, it helps clarify what has happened in the professional world during the social media age, which is that it's somehow convinced most people in the professional world that they too are rainmakers. And so you're absolutely right. I talk about it in the book that there's certain jobs that being very connected is very important, and deep work is not at all relevant. It's a relatively narrow slice of the economy, but those jobs have always been there. And somehow in recent years, that behavior has mutated out to now you have lawyers doing it and computer programmers doing it and authors doing it, people who have nothing to do with needing lots of contacts and have everything to do with my brain creates value and the harder I concentrate, the more value I produce. And so I think that's the important question for people to ask is, I mean, you don't want to confuse the two, but you also don't want to extrapolate and say, well, I know a product marketer who gets great success out of Facebook ads, because if you're selling a product, Facebook ads are fantastic. You can target people. I mean, it's a huge boon for people who market products. But then don't take that lesson away if you're a CPA or a computer programmer and think Facebook is also going to be crucial to my career. I think we need to be more precise and grounded in reality of the way we talk about it. For most people, these tools are not that important. And, you know, let's just use myself as a case study. I've never had a social media account. Never had a social media account, even though I'm in fields where you're supposed to need them. I mean, how can you be an author if you don't have a social media account? And I can tell you it's had no discernible negative impact on my career. And I can think of many positive impacts I've had by freeing myself from that mental obligation. And because it turns out with books, actually, you don't have to aggressively market yourself in social media. If you write good books, people who like them maybe will talk about it on their social media account, but it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm a professor. A lot of professors think they need to be online and talking about these things. That doesn't matter. I mean, mainly people want to know how well do you teach? What did you publish? Did it matter? Are people citing it? I mean, these fields are pretty simple. Authors should focus 99% on writing great books. Professors should focus 99% on teaching and writing great research papers. It's old fashioned, but the old fashioned stuff works. I'm not as impressed as a lot of people about this need to be on these mobile advertisement apps that we're being convinced is somehow crucial to surviving in the 21st century.
Yeah. And, you know, part of that problem is that this is one of the bad negative side effects of allowing, for example, lawyers to advertise. You know, years ago, lawyers weren't allowed to advertise. And guess what? Their focus wasn't on advertising. And now they are. And so they're, you know, that's a big part of their focus is just be out there and do all this stuff. And, you know, that's the whole reason that, for example, the Rotary Club was created is because lawyers couldn't advertise. And so they would have to get their business through networking. You know, you could spend a limited amount of time networking, whereas now you could spend all your time on social media and advertising campaigns. So it's really, you know, Stephen Covey, again, I love his work. I love your work. And one of the things he always said is the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And I think that's really what deep work is about. So I'm really glad you're getting this message out there, Cal. Where can people find you and find out more about it? I guess they're not going to find you on social media.
Yes, you're not going to find me on social media. I'm not that easy to reach necessarily, but it's easy to find out about my ideas. My website, calnewport.com, is where I blog. So actually, you know, there's 10 years worth of posts on all these ideas you can dive into. You can also find out a little bit more about me and my books there as well.
Fantastic. Well, Cal Newport, thank you so much. Did you just want to give a quick word about the, I know you did mention it, but the So Good They Can't Ignore You book, because we really focused on the deep work. But if you just want to give a parting thought on that, feel free.
Sure. Well, let's just say if you're one of the people who's a little bit fatigued about everyone telling you, just follow your passion, just follow your passion, just follow your passion. And you're one of the people who think, isn't it a little bit more complicated than that? Than just, I'm meant to do this. And once I find it, I'll love it from day one. This is a book you'll probably enjoy checking out, because I essentially spent a couple years diving into the research literature, interviewing people from a variety of different fields who love what they do for a living, and just tried to figure out how do people actually end up loving their work. And it turns out that slogan, just follow your passion, really doesn't get you there.
Mm-hmm. I like how you're debunking that idea. That's a great book too. Cal Newport, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jason. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.